New York Times bestselling author and illustrator Brian Selznick will talk about his Caldecott Award-winning book, The Invention of Hugo Cabret, and how it became Martin Scorsese's 2011 Oscar-winning film, Hugo, on Sunday at the Mehewe Theater in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Following the screening of the film, Selznick will participate in a Q&A with his Scholastic editor, Berkshire resident Tracy Mack, and then sign books. Selznick graduated from the Rhode Island School of Design with the intention of becoming a set designer for the theater. However, after spending 3 years selling books and designing window displays for a children's bookstore in Manhattan, he was inspired to create children's books of his own. It is a great delight to welcome Brian Selznick back to the roundtable. Brian, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi there.
It is a delight to have you join us, and of course, a delight to have you in the region on Sunday for this event. When you get chances to not only see the film, but then talk about your work as well, do you find that they both, because many authors will say, well, the book is the book and the movie is the movie, which I assume you also agree with, but so is it ever awkward for you to talk about them simultaneously?
Well, it's funny because the movie, I was very lucky. The movie is an incredibly faithful adaptation of the book, and I've become friends with John Logan, who wrote the screenplay adaptation, and I find myself, when I'm talking about the story, forgetting if I'm discussing something that he made up to change for the movie or if it's something that was in the book, or because I've read the screenplay so often before the movie was made, that and he did such a good job that he came up with certain solutions for the screen that were really good, and I was like, oh, is that mine or is that his? And so we've both realized that this is a situation that doesn't usually happen. I do think it's true that normally the book writer and the screenplay writer do not normally get along very well. But, you know, I haven't seen the movie in about a year, and I haven't read the book in, I don't think I've read the book completely since it came out in 2007. And so I'm really, really looking forward to seeing it.
Is that on purpose, or is it just because life gets in the way?
You know, I think it's hard sometimes to sit down and reread something that I had made. I mean, I've talked about it a lot, and you know, I love talking about making the book with kids when I go to schools and you know different audiences. But you know, but then I'm working on another book, and I'm in that world, and I'm focusing on that, and hopefully that eventually gets finished, and you know, then it's time to work on another one. And so, yeah, so I guess time just keeps moving forward, and especially now with the movie out, I keep feeling like I really do need to reread the book again, because people keep asking me questions about the book, and I'm like, oh, I don't remember. I think that was in my book, but John might have come up with that, you know, because as I was reading the early drafts of the script, you know, there would be things either that I thought were in my book which weren't, or there were a couple of things where I just thought, that's a terrible solution. Why is he changing, you know, this you know, complicated, interesting, you know, what I thought was an interesting part of the plot to just like a simple, you know, to simplify it in this way. But then when I saw what they were doing with it on screen, I realized that those places where it's simplified are a way of making it work for the camera. And so, you know, my book's very profusely illustrated, so they had a sort of a leg up for the adaptation because they were able to use the picture sequences as, you know, as sort of like a storyboards. But the storytelling needed to change in certain places because it's a different art form. You know, I'm telling the story the way I can in a book. And again, my book's about movies, so
right.
I was actually trying to, you know, make the book feel like a movie, but I thought the book was unfilmable because at the end the book actually becomes part of the plot. But, you know, but then Martin Scorsese called and said he wanted to make it into a movie. So I figured, well, I guess maybe it can be adapted.
So a lot of follow-up questions to what you just said. I mean, one of the things I vividly remember, I was at Book Expo America before this book came out, and this book was like the buzz of the show. Everybody was talking about this book, and you got to see it, you got to see it, you got to see it. And, you know, no offense, but you hear that a lot at Book Expo. So, and you're like, yeah, okay, great. I remember physically taking it out of my bag and looking at it that night and becoming just transfixed, and by morning convinced that it was, and I believe still rightly so, that it was a masterpiece. I mean, it is such an amazing piece of work. For people who are not familiar, you talk about it being profusely illustrated. I mean, we go 50, almost 60 pages before there is word one. And yeah. the pages are black, and there is it pencil? Pencil drawing mostly?
Yeah, they're pencil.
Pencil drawing. Some of them very small, some that encompass the entire page. And it is so striking and brings and sets such a tone and such a mood. And I think that it's hard even to classify it, isn't it?
Hmm. Yeah, it was, you know, very much inspired by graphic novels, but it's not a graphic novel. There, even if the drawing's small, there's only one drawing on each page. And then most of the drawings are, as you said, full page spread. So in order to move through the pictures, you actually have to turn the page, which gives you this physical action, and you move through space, you move through time to get to the next moment. So, you know, so I had written the text all the way through before I got this idea to tell the book a little bit like a movie, a little bit like a picture book. And my editor, Tracy Mack, who lives up in the Berkshires and, you know, who I had worked with very closely on this, really encouraged me to push forward with this idea. So I was, you know, taking out big chunks of text, replacing them with these picture sequences so that you experience the story both visually, because usually in a novel for older kids, if there's any pictures, it's like one drawing, a chapter, you know, maybe, and they're not very important. But I wanted it to be more like a picture book, like you could think of like The Wild Rumpus and Where the Wild Things Are, where there's no more words, and you as the reader just move through those pages. And I found that really exciting. So I was like, how can I get that into a novel? Yeah, so it's I think it's like 550-page book with 300 pages of pictures.
And as I said, the pictures are so atmospheric. And because they are black and white, they have a wonderful mood. And not to be at all, even though the color can be gray, they can show great joy and delight as well. I'm curious as to were there, it seems as though you wanted to lead people to have their imagination be the driver here. And yes, you would bring them down a path, but to kind of create a backstory for these characters through the situation that they were in and the expressions that they had on their faces.
Yeah, I mean, I very much like the idea of the reader as collaborator, so that everything isn't handed to you directly. You know, you as the reader have to do some work. And so the text is written in such a way that most of the description, much of the emotional content is experienced through the pictures. So I wanted the pictures to serve purposes that in novels, you know, are usually given over to the text. And so my goal was that at the end of the book, you wouldn't actually remember what you looked at and what you read, that it would all sort of combine together in your head to form this one narrative, so that there really was all of this work happening. And again, it shouldn't, and I'm using the word work, but of course it shouldn't actually feel like work. It's just that the combination should happen inside your head. And so it does change the way you experience the narrative. And so, you know, looking at the train station where much of the story takes place, looking at the face of this boy and the different things he experiences. And then we also, of course, through pictures, I can actually put you in his shoes and put you in his point of view so that you actually see what he's seeing, so that you're able to experience what the character's experiencing in a way that's, you know, similar to what you can do in a first-person text, but also a little different, because your mind works differently whether or not it's looking at pictures or whether it's reading text. Although ultimately, both of them are just forms of storytelling, but it was for me about the excitement of what happens when those two things combine, and how that experience changes when you're handed back and forth between words and pictures in this fashion.
You spoke a moment ago about working with your editor, Tracy Mack, who will also be on the panel with you at the Mahawi on Sunday from the Berkshires, and that process of taking out huge chunks of text. Is it two separate professions for you? I mean, is there a writing hat and an illustration hat, or is it a very, or are they, in working on it, that they come together and you're working on them simultaneously?
It's weird because I tend to think in images, but then I never draw first. I always write everything first. Even if I know that I'm going to be drawing a sequence of pictures, I will write down what I want the drawings to be. Like, you know, we see this, we see this, we see this.
Right.
But for Hugo, I had this like image of a kid climbing through the garbage and finding this broken automaton, this very complicated wind-up machine. But I then developed it solely as a written story because I didn't know how I was going to illustrate it. And so I had all, you know, like pages and pages of what I thought were, you know, very pretty descriptions of the train station and the vaults of the iron railings rising above the kid like dinosaur skeletons. And, you know, I had all this stuff. Pigeons were trapped in the train station that, you know, like were symbols the way Hugo and the old man were trapped in the train station. But when I had this idea to try to tell part of the story with pictures, I realized that I could do most of that work visually. So so it was very painful, and that was one of the things Tracy really encouraged me to do, was to, like, if I'm going to cut some of that description, I should go ahead and cut all of it and replace it with pictures. And so that's why, you know, in the book now, you know, you see the moon, and then you turn the page, you see the moon over Paris, you know, exemplified by the Eiffel Tower, of course. Then you turn the page and we are zooming into a train station, and we turn the page and we get closer, and we turn the page and we go inside, and we turn the page and we see a crowd, and we eventually, you know, are led to this boy amid the crowd, and then we follow him. So, as you said, for almost 50 pages, we are just following this kid visually through the picture sequence. And there is a little intro. I was actually a little nervous that people were going to think it was too strange to suddenly find pictures. So I once heard an author named M.T. Anderson talk about books, and he talked about how all books teach you how to read them. And I thought that was such a beautiful idea that I thought, I need to have my book teach you how to read it. So in the intro, I have a little statement about what you're about to see. You know, you're about to imagine that, like, the lights are going down and you're going to come to a train station and you're going to find this kid, follow him. His name is Hugo Cabret. And then you get to the pictures and there you find him. There he is. You follow him. But then it's like I've handed you over, because suddenly he starts doing stuff that I didn't tell you about in text. He finds a metal grate. He climbs in the metal grate. He goes into the walls of the train station. He finds a toy booth. He looks down at the toy booth. He sees an old man. He sees a little girl. So suddenly the book has taken you from what feels like the safety of the text into this sort of somewhat safe area of the pictures. But then it's like you're thrown over the edge, and it's like, all right, now I'm just going to follow along. And then when you finally do get to a page of text, there's one sentence of text or two before you turn the page and you're plunged into another picture. So then, you know, hopefully by that point you have caught on that the whole book is going to constantly be handed back and forth in this fashion.
In that introduction, you write, but before you turn the page, I want you to picture yourself sitting in the darkness, like the beginning of a movie. On screen, the sun will soon rise, and you will find yourself zooming toward a train station in the middle of the city. And then you open the book, and I remember the first time I read that introduction and I read the book, and it was breathtaking. It was really like, oh my God, I'm in this place and this is incredible. Getting back to what you said at the very beginning, when I saw Hugo on screen, to have that feeling replicated is something that I've never had from a movie translation before, because Scorsese brings you in to that, into that train station cinematically with great color, very different from what you did, but still breathtaking in its delivery.
Yeah, like, you know, seeing it in color through his eyes was such an incredible thrill. And then he, even though, it, you know, it's in color, it's in 3D, these are all elements that obviously are not part of the book, but he took every one of my drawings and used them as an actual storyboard for his camera. So even though his camera is filming in color, it's filming in 3D, the movement of the camera is echoing exactly, or almost exactly, what I drew. And so the book was made to feel like a movie, because it has so much to do with the history of cinema and Georges Méliès. And as you just read, I ask the reader to even imagine that the book is a movie. And again, just to reiterate this, when I was making the book, I really did not think it could ever be filmed as a movie. I can't make that case strongly enough.
Right.
You know, so then, you know, the first time I saw a cut of the movie was a screening that Scorsese had for us in his private screening room. It was me and Tracy and some people who had helped make the book. And I was sitting there, and, you know, I knew the screenplay was close to the book because I had read it. I knew the sets were close to my drawings because I had been on the set. But it wasn't until I saw that first cut of the movie that I realized that he was meticulously recreating my drawings. I became friends with some of the guys who did the special effects, who won an Oscar for their special effects for the movie. And there's, you know, the sequence where Hugo falls onto the train tracks. And in my book, you see the train far away, you turn the page, the train's a little closer, you turn the page, the train's a little closer, you turn the page, and the train's filling the whole, you know, spread. And of course, in a movie, you could just, like, take the camera and have the train zoom right towards you. But what Scorsese did was, in that sequence, he actually recreated my page turns. So you see the train in the distance, and it cuts, and the train's closer, and it cuts again, the train's closer, and then it cuts, and the train has filled the screen to exactly reproduce my drawings. And this guy, Ben, who did the special effects, said that if they tried to change the composition at all or redo the train in any way that deviated from what I drew, Scorsese would tell them to go back and make it look like my drawings. Mm. Like, he had... I became friends with Scorsese's assistant, and Tommaso's job, he said, was mostly carrying around like 6 extra copies of my book, because Scorsese would hand them to everybody, and the book's heavy, you know, so he always had to have copies, because, you know, Scorsese would say, you know, do this, you know, recreate that,
right.
This is what we're doing, and, you know, everybody had a copy of the book, and so I think that made a real difference when they were translating it to the screen.
So somewhere there have to be authors out there who are looking at the radio right now, or have subsequently, since you have told this story, have come up to you and say, look, this ain't the way it is. this is not, you got very lucky.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I've been describing myself like Kate Middleton's father. Like, I feel like, you know, I have this daughter. I'm very proud of her. She's beautiful, you know, and I think she's beautiful, you know, but she married the prince, you know, like,
yeah.
I made a book that was that Martin Scorsese, first of all, just the fact finding out that Martin Scorsese read my book and liked it was
thrilling. That's good enough. Yeah, that's great.
That was really good enough, because the chance that any book is going to be made into a movie is minuscule. And then the chance that an option is going to, you know, happen, and then that, and then for that option to actually get made, and then for it to get made by Martin Scorsese, like, I recognize that every one of those steps are extremely unlikely. So the fact that it happened, the fact that Scorsese, you know, fell in love with the book, and timing worked out, and everything worked out for his entire team of collaborators, you know, Dante Ferretti and Sandy Powell and John Logan, for all of these people to come together, and on top of that, for all of them, led by Scorsese, to say, make it as close to the book as you can. And, you know, as I said earlier, there of course have to be things that change, and, you know, and I think they very brilliantly came up with a change to the ending of the story, where my book is a celebration of cinema, but ultimately it's about the importance of books. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they took that and they reversed it, and they made a movie that actually celebrates books. There's, you know, kids who write and kids who read, and there's libraries and bookstores throughout the whole story. But ultimately, Martin Scorsese made a movie about the importance of movies, which is just what he should do, and that's his art form, and that's the thing that he loves most. And, you know, and so to have made something that inspired him. I mean, it's always wonderful to make something that inspires someone else to make something new that they wouldn't have done. But, you know, and also, like, Hugo's named after a toy that I had as a kid. So, like, thinking about the fact that, you know, Martin Scorsese made a movie named after my favorite toy from childhood, you know, that he then spent all of this time and love making. And I have to say, you know, I think the movie's great. Like, I think the movie is really beautiful, and, you know, outside of the fact that it's so close to my story and all these things that I made up, you know, I look at the movie, and again, it's mine and it's not mine, and all the parts of it that aren't mine, I'm very proud of, you know, I just think that it's the movie came out last year. I'm really looking forward to seeing it again, as I said. But, you know, it's, I'm just very happy to have it out there as this thing that people can go and enjoy. And if, you know, and if they haven't read the book, it could then bring them to the book also. So you can see sort of where it came from when Scorsese translated it to the screen.
And we only have about a minute left, but I do have to say that your follow-up to it, Wonderstruck, was absolutely beautiful as well. And even more illustrations in that book.
Yeah, that the idea for Wonderstruck was, you know, to tell the story about a deaf kid through pictures, so that the pictures in a way sort of echo the way that the child experiences the world. So there's all these elements of deafness and deaf culture, but also part of the story takes place in the 1920s. So in 27, which is the year that sound was introduced to film, so to play with silent movies again, but within the context of someone who's deaf, seemed like a really interesting way to play with it. And now I'm working on another story that also is going to, I think it's going to have even more pictures than Wonderstruck. you know, but that's part of the challenge, is to figure out what the pictures are doing and why they're there, and to make something where the subject and the way it's made are, you know, inextricably linked, if that's the right word. I think that's the right word.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's and again, the work is so beautiful and so intricate, and it's one of those things that you can pour over and really spend, you know, minutes, if not hours, just on any one page, any one panel, which is an absolute delight. Brian Selznick will talk about his Caldecott Award-winning book, The Invention of Hugo Cabret, and how it became Martin Scorsese's 2011 Oscar-winning film, Hugo, on Sunday at the Mahaley Theater in Great Barrington. It takes place at 2 o'clock. It will include a Q&A with his Scholastic editor, Berkshire resident Tracy Mack, and also, of course, a screening of the film and then a book signing afterwards. Brian, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Have a wonderful time at the Mahaley, and thank you so much for the wonderful work that you've given us and talking to us this morning.
Oh, thank you. It was really great to talk to you.
A delight. Thank you. Again, Brian Selznick at the Mehewi Theater in Great Barrington at 2 o'clock, mehewi.org for more information. M-A-H-A-I-W-E, mehewi.org for more information. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.